this is part two in a three-part series about some of the basic aspects of hurricanes, which I thought was perhaps an appropriate thing for this meeting. And the three topics I wanted to cover, in fact I probably won't get time to cover them all, but see how we go, are buoyancy, size, and the boundary layer. And I'll go through these one by one. I wanted to talk for the first perhaps 15 minutes about buoyancy. And this came about partly I had a, well, many years ago, I was always puzzled by the idea that the eye was the warmest place in the storm. And the question was, are the eye wall clouds really buoyant relative to the eye? Well, they can't be in a sense because the eye is warmer than the eye wall clouds. So to what extent can we apply buoyancy ideas to the hurricane? And that was for a long time a little bit of a mystery. And then I wrote a review paper on convection in about 2000. And Kerry looked at this paper and made some, I'd used buoyancy a lot, and Kerry made some remark about this, which led me into thinking more deeply about the problem of buoyancy. And so this talk is sort of emerged with that background. Another question is a hurricane warm cord everywhere? Now, when the planes fly through, they usually fly at constant pressure, but the pressure surfaces go down in the core. So the question is the hurricane, in fact, warm cored everywhere at constant height? That is, if you were to fly through a constant height, would it would there still be a warm anomaly in the center at every height? And in particular, what would be the sort of balanced temperature perturbation at the surface in the simplest case? The material I'm going to talk about is contained in these two papers, one with Mike and Hongyan Su, which is in Dynamics of Atmospheres and Oceans a couple of years ago, and a slightly more recent paper where I tried to look at the solutions for a balanced vortex. So let's look at the buoyancy, and the way that one usually learns about buoyancy is the idea that if you think of a parcel which has a density rho in a stably stratified fluid where the pressure is changing with height in the environment P0 of Z and the density at height Z is rho 0. And we think of there being two forces acting on this fluid parcel. There's the Archimedes force, which is the force per unit mass, which is the gravity times the density of the environment. So that's really the weight per unit mass of air which is displaced. And then there's the actual weight of the parcel, which is rho times g acting downwards. And the net of these forces is just the buoyancy force. An express per unit mass we have to divide by a rho in here. So that's the usual way that one obtains the buoyancy force in a fluid. Now, in a rapidly rotating fluid, if you do the same kind of calculation, well, the first thing is that the lines of constant density and the lines of constant pressure of the environment actually dip down towards the center. So the force is clearly, if you apply the same ideas that we just applied, we really have to look at the local forces in this region, which are, and the Archimedes force turns out to be in the direction normal to the pressure surfaces, and it has a similar form upwards to what we had before, but now the there's an effective gravity because there's a gravitational force acting downwards, but there's also centrifugal and Coriolis forces acting outwards, and so the parcel is feeling these fields as well. And we can think in terms of a generalized buoyancy, which has a radial inwards component as well as a vertical component if the density of the parcel is less than its environment. But we're really comparing the density with its environment along surfaces of constant pressure. This is not the same as the generalized buoyancy which Kerry defines in his book. He uses a different terminology. But you can think of this as a kind of centrifuge effect. If you had some light fluid in this rapidly rotating vortex, it would tend to be drawn in towards the axis through the this component of force, and if it was heavier than the environment, it would be centrifuged outwards. Now, to calculate this generalized buoyancy, I'll show you that we have to be able to calculate the slopes of these surfaces. I'll show you how to do that. Now, there's another way that buoyancy is sometimes developed in books on fluid dynamics in particular, and the idea is that we now start with the vertical momentum equation. W is the vertical velocity, P is the total pressure here. What we sometimes do is we extract a background pressure and density field from the flow, so we define the density as the background density, as which is a function of height plus a perturbation. The same for the pressure. And we insist that the reference density and pressure satisfy the hydrostatic equation. When we do that, this equation up here reduces to this one, where now this dP prime by dz is a vertical perturbation pressure gradient, and the buoyancy in here, this term is the same as the definition that we had before. Now, if you think of this development here, this expression for B, which defines, depends on the definition of the rho zero z. So it's not unique. In many calculations that we do when we start with a flow, we have some undisturbed environment, then it's the obvious choice is to take rho to be the density in the undisturbed environment. But in the atmosphere, we don't have an undisturbed environment. So we have to decide what to do about rho. And one of the typical things, we might take a horizontal average across the domain. We could, if we were perverse enough, take an eye sounding, the density in the eye of a tropical cyclone, and define that as this reference density. And the buoyancy would be rather different. So buoyancy is actually not a unique quantity. It depends on this reference density. and I'm going to refer to this buoyancy later as the system buoyancy.
What really matters is the buoyancy gradient, am I right?
That's right.
And that then, it really doesn't matter what you have.
Well, when you say it's what really matters, it is the buoyancy which appears in the vertical momentum equation. When you start looking at circulations, you're absolutely right. Now, it turns out that derivation that I've just shown works equally as well if the density, the reference density field, is a function of radius and height and time. In other words, if the if we have the density field of a balanced axisymmetric vortex, then we can define a perturbation relative to that, and likewise a pressure perturbation relative to the pressure field here.
No, in a way, isn't it what we already do? Because the balanced axisymmetric vortex is the dual potential, in the sense when we adjust the dual potential for the fact that the Earth isn't spherical. In a way, we're sort of doing this.
Yeah, but this is not, this is for a
right, for
specific
arcing,
motor.
So we're doing a
yeah.
system, but it's sort of analogous.
Yeah. Oh yeah, sure, sure, sure. So the point is that these fields here can be in thermal wind balance with a particular tangential wind field. Now, when we define the buoyancy with this respect to this field here, of course, this buoyancy in here is different, and this perturbation pressure is going to be different. But the sum of those terms will be the same as before. And then call this the low, excuse me, the local buoyancy.
Could I ask one question here? You made a choice when you decided to look at a particular direction of the acceleration that is in the vertical, but in a rapidly rotating vortex, what you mean by convection often has a horizontal component, pure inertial, so these are pretty analogous to that. So could you have elected to look at the acceleration in the direction that's sort of parallel to the vector that consists of gravity and centrifugal forces?
In this?
Yeah. I'll define the buoyancy in that direction.
I'm not sure whether that would bring any more.
That would be more like your change of the verticals.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I guess you could. But I guess the point here is that by changing the reference density to be the one of the balanced vortex, we get a different definition of buoyancy. We get a different pressure gradient, but the sum has to be the same locally. Now, if we, the typical thing is that we would say, think of a vortex which had a particular radial and vertical structure, may even depend with time. And we want to calculate the, we will need then to calculate this density field of the balanced vortex to be able to represent the buoyancy in this way. So the question is, what is, how do we do that? And can we do it without making too many approximations? And it turns out we can do it exactly. And it's the usual way that we start. We make the gradient, we assume that the flow is in gradient wind balance and hydrostatic balance. We eliminate the pressure gradients from these using this relationship here. We end up with an equation which relates the radial and height variation of the density field to the tangential wind field. So if we're given a tangential wind field as a function of radius and height, this is then just a first order partial differential equation for the log of the density. We haven't made any approximation like Boussinesq or inelastic approximations which would treat the density just as a function of height. So this is essentially an exact equation. And so we can solve that in principle. In fact, in practice, we can also do it quite easily to find the density field associated with any tangential wind field, assuming it's axis symmetric, of course. When you slightly rewrite this equation by dividing by the gravity, then we see that this term here, when we solve this first order differential equation, then this thing here is like a dz by the r, and that just defines the characteristics, and it's very easy to show that the characteristics for this differential equation, of course, is the isobaric surfaces. And we can solve the characteristics for the height given the tangential wind field as a function of radius and height. We can find the height of the these surfaces, isobaric surfaces. And then this equation reduces to a d by the r of log rho along these surfaces. And we can solve that simultaneously with the characteristics, and we can get the variation of density along these surfaces. And that will give us the density, the balanced density field. No approximation. So what we can now do, we've got the variation of the density equation for that along constant pressure surfaces, and we can see that that's related to the vertical gradient of the V. For a barotropic vortex, the V by the Z is zero, that means that the rho by the R is zero from here. And since this is a constant pressure surface, rho is inversely proportional to T, and so that that means that the T by the R is zero. So in fact, temperature is a constant on these surfaces for a barotropic vortex. And that means that a barotropic vortex is cold cored because the lines of constant pressure slope down towards the center of the vortex. And temperature is a constant on these, and temperature is decreasing with time. For a baroclinic vortex where the tangential wind field decreases with height, the radial density increases with height, with radius, and the temperature then decreases with radius. And so a baroclinic vortex where the tangential wind field decreases with height will be warm cored, but along constant pressure surfaces here. So the question, but the constant pressure surfaces drop down, so is it warm cored everywhere? So, in summary, a barotropic vortex is cold cored if the temperature contrast is measured at constant height. The baroclinic vortex is warm cored if the temperature contrasts are measured at constant height, but only if the V by DZ is large enough. If it's not large enough, then the effect of the dipping down of the surfaces is not big enough to reverse the sign of the gradient. And this is a typical calculation which is done solving those that differential equation. Given this tangential wind field, which is sort of hurricane scale, tangential wind field is largest near the surface, decreases in height, and has a maximum at about 40 kilometers here. And these are the lines of constant density in that situation, and these are the lines of constant temperature deviation. These are at constant height. Okay. So near the surface, because the vortex is not varying very rapidly with height, the tangential wind field is actually, the gradient here is zero. And therefore it looks like a barotropic vortex slow down. And so it's actually cold cored near the surface, but it's warm cored through much of the depth of the atmosphere. And I think you really have to do the calculation for a particular vortex to see how big these numbers are. It's not immediately obvious, I think, from without doing it. Then there was the question here. Here we have a possible explanation for having cold temperature anomalies in the inner core region, just from the balance approximation. For this vortex, which is only 40 meters per second, which is only a little bit over hurricane strength, this temperature perturbation is not very large. It's about 1 degree, but it goes up if you increase the strength of the vortex. And 65 meters per second, this is about 3 degrees maximum.
And you do see in the ground formation consistently.
Yeah.
But there are complications with in the boundary layer, but you do see cooling in the boundary layer.
Pick this up maybe in the next part. Just wanted to show this. This is a picture from some simulations of a hurricane from Scott Brown, who did a similar thing, but took the not just the symmetric part of the circulation as the reference frame, but also took wave number one. But what he did show was that these dashed lines are the contours of theta V, I think theta V perturbation. And the shaded here are vertical velocity greater than a certain threshold. And so here we're looking at the sort of the strong updrafts in the simulation. And we're looking at this local buoyancy, or the temperature perturbation relative to the vortex's background temperature field. And I guess what it's showing is that mostly the vertical velocity perturbations, the upward perturbations, are closely related to these regions of local buoyancy.
So let me understand, this data V is defined relative, it's a perturbation, and the perturbation is relative to the background state defined like you do it? Or?
Not quite. He also takes out wave number one.
Okay.
And puts that in the perturbation, but there's no reason why not to do that.
Yeah.
But the point is then, of course, that the local buoyancy, in a sense, is relative, relative to whatever background state you choose. So basically what we can do is we can think of as, first of all, in a rapidly rotating vortex, buoyancy has a radial as well as a vertical component. It turns out, if you do a scale analysis, this radial component is not very large in a tropical cyclone. The vertical component depends on the definition of the reference density. And one can distinguish between system buoyancy. The system buoyancy is when we use a density variation which doesn't vary with radius, so we take an average density. And then the whole of the vortex, or much of the vortex, is just warm cored. And so we can think of this as sort of system buoyancy. But then we can talk about individual clouds and look whether they have buoyancy relative to the background state of the vortex. And that's what I call local buoyancy. In this previous picture, was showing that the clouds, at least in the model, do have some local buoyancy. But to define the local buoyancy, you have to be able to define the reference density field, which is in thermal imbalance with the tangential velocity field. Barotropic vortices are cold cored because temperature is a function of pressure, and the isobaric surfaces drop down near the center of the vortex. But baroclinic vortices are cold cored near the surface if dV by dZ is small near the surface. And they're warm cored aloft if dV by dZ, or if minus dV by dZ, is large enough. And the final remark here is that there is a temperature perturbation at the surface associated with a balanced vortex. And the typical DTs for a strong hurricane are a few degrees. Okay, that's all of part one. It looks as if I'm not going to get to number three, but there's not much of number three anyway. Another topic I wanted to talk about here, which I think is also a sort of very fundamental issue in hurricanes, is the boundary layer. And some of you will know about boundary layers in ordinary fluid flows. And the simple cases is when you have a flow past a flat plate, and on the flat plate, there's a frictional stress on the plate, and the flow slows down above the plate, and we get a boundary layer which is growing downstream along the plate. And the flow in the boundary layer is, of course, slower than it is outside the boundary layer. That's the typical aerodynamic boundary layer. And outside the boundary layer, in this simple problem, you get a balance between the acceleration, I'll think about the steady problem here, and the pressure gradient parallel to the plate. And you can write down the Navier-Stokes equations in the boundary layer. And as most of you know, you go through some scaling, which shows that the main gradient in the boundary layer is the vertical gradient. So throw this term away in the horizontal momentum equation. And in the vertical momentum equation, a scaling shows that this term here is actually rather larger than these, but this is very small if the Reynolds number is large. And the conclusion from this is that the pressure gradient normal to the boundary is relatively small, and therefore the pressure gradient outside the boundary is basically the same as the pressure gradient in the boundary layer, and so you can then replace the pressure gradient in the outer flow in the boundary layer, and you get an equation like this. So if given u as a function of x, you can solve this equation. This equation is parabolic because you've thrown away one of these terms in here. That's a very quick...
As a mathematician, it's not necessarily parabolic. It depends on your sign of little u.
Okay.
U is positive,
sure.
It's
okay.
Parabolic.
Yeah.
When you reverse
right.
things, it's
anti-parabolic.
Yeah,
but it's parabolic in one direction, right?
No. You can't march in u.
Right.
You can't march in u.
That's
if you
correct.
Reverse the
no.
velocity.
That's correct.
It's
you're
anti-parabolic
right.
and L post.
Yeah,
that's
sorry.
Correct.
The sense in which I'm thinking
this
of
this is a math
here.
Institute,
yeah, yeah.
So these comments have to be made.
Right,
but actually, this is
and it's relevant physically.
No. This is the
pressure gradient.
This comes up in just a few minutes, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Adverse pressure gradient.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Quite right. Okay, now what happens in a vortex? In a vortex, we have a tangential. Let's think of the simple situation where we have a flow which is a function of r above the boundary, above some boundary here where friction is active. Above the boundary layer, let's assume that we have gradient wind balance, which means that there's a pressure gradient force inwards towards the vortex axis, and that's balanced by the centrifugal and Coriolis forces which are acting outwards. As we come down towards the boundary, the centrifugal forces and the Coriolis forces are reduced by friction because the tangential wind is slowed down. That leaves a net pressure gradient because, the pressure gradient of the outer flow is transmitted into the boundary layer. That leaves a net pressure gradient into the boundary layer. And that net pressure gradient into the boundary layer drives the secondary circulation. So this is a very fundamental aspect of vortices, and it's the principal reason why vortices spin down. I should have done brought my little teacup experiment to do, which shows this very nicely. Now, we know in hurricanes this vertical circulation is very important. This is associated with the convection. So the question is, how does the vertical circulation associated, say, with the convection or with the buoyancy in the core, in some sense, how does that all fit together with the boundary layer? We've clearly got a very tightly coupled problem through the boundary layer. So the boundary layer is important because it provides a very powerful coupling between the primary circulation, that is the circulation, the tangential circulation, and the secondary circulation, which is the radial vertical circulation. Also, the moisture enters a hurricane from the sea surface, and the radial distribution of moisture, which is coming out of the boundary layer, is strongly influenced by, for example, the winds of the boundary layer. The vertical transport of moisture and angular momentum out of the boundary layer is essentially determined by the dynamics and thermodynamics of the boundary layer itself. So the boundary layer is exerting a very, very important constraint on the problem. Now, if you look at some of the papers on the boundary layer, they're suggesting that the maximum wind speed in the boundary layer can actually exceed that above the boundary layer. We saw that this doesn't really, it's not the situation over the flow over a flat plate, but it turns out that this can happen in a hurricane, or I leave the question, can it happen? And that's
in the hurricane community, what do they think of when they say the word boundary layer? Are they thinking of the layer below cloud? Is that what they're thinking of? Is that layer, are they thinking of the layer?
People aren't always very specific what they say, but I would like to think of it here as the sub-cloud layer. I'll show you something, if I have time, of some calculations of Jeff Kepert's, which relates to this point. So this is an unusual feature in general of boundary layers, that the winds in the boundary layer can be stronger than those above. And it seems to be a feature, or a possible feature, of the termination boundary layer in all intense vortices. But I just remind you of that because that's a point I'd like to come back to a little later. Anthes, in his book, I think it was in his book, but now I just forget, pointed out that the increase of V due to large radial displacements in the boundary layer with partial conservation of absolute angular momentum opposes a frictional loss of absolute angular momentum to the surface. The idea here is that above the boundary layer, fluid converges, it's absolute angular momentum which is conserved, that is r times the velocity plus the half r squared f. But in the boundary layer, the flow is losing absolute angular momentum to the boundary. But if you can have a large enough displacement in the boundary layer, large enough inward radial displacement, maybe you can have the wind speeds in the boundary layer stronger than those above. Now, some of the consequences of this, it means that the maximum winds in a hurricane can occur very close to the surface. It also means that there are strong moisture fluxes near the surface over many conditions because of the strong winds, or partly due to the strong winds there. These strong winds drive large ocean wave fields, and these strong winds do damage at landfall. So the boundary layer, the fact that the winds are very, very strong low down, is an important feature of hurricanes. People use wind reduction factors to relate the maximum flight level winds observed by the reconnaissance aircraft to winds near the surface. And these could be in error because these wind reduction factors are sometimes 5 to 10%. But of course, if the winds in the boundary layer are stronger than the winds at flight level, then these reduction factors are clearly not very sensible. Kerry, in his tensile intensity code, at least the version, the last version I saw, reduces Vm by 20%, right? To account for these, the effect of friction, but that might not be correct if the winds in the boundary layer are as strong as they are aloft. Might not be accurate.
I'm just puzzling all that. Somehow, if they're stronger in the boundary layer, that would seem to sort of resist that secondary circulation. Because isn't I always think of that secondary circulation as being driven by the decrease of the wind speed in the boundary layer, and so you have this imbalance between the pressure. And
maybe could we pick that
yeah.
up later on? Because I want to get back to that kind of thing. Now, some years ago, my late colleague Wolfgang Ulrich did some interesting calculations. We were running an axisymmetric model, and one of the questions we were posing was where, if we get a vortex, a hurricane-like vortex, which intensifies to a certain maximum tangential wind speed, and then we look at the ring of fluid in an axisymmetric model, we're looking at rings of fluid, and we said, where does that ring of fluid come from which has the maximum tangential wind speed at any time, anywhere in the storm? Where does that ring come from? And we did some calculations by varying the Coriolis parameter. We had some sort of background value, and then we halved it and doubled it. And the thing that surprised me at that stage was that this maximum wind speed always came from a long way out in the boundary layer. I had expected to find that that came from air converging above the boundary layer. In fact, it always came from a long way out in the boundary layer. And of course, the as you increase F, you increase the inertial stiffness of the problem, and you it seems that you can't draw fluid parcels from as far out. So the ability to for these parcels to converge in the boundary layer depends on F.
That's the back trajectory, but it doesn't really tell you where the angular momentum came from. Because you're mixing.
Yeah, you are. That's right. It was suggested, but unfortunately my colleague died about a year ago or year and a half ago, and since then he was ill for a long time, and these calculations have just got shelved. So just when they were getting interesting, and we're hoping to get them going again very soon. I'm going to have to move on rather quickly. There's a lot of literature, and I've just thought about theoretical literature in the boundary layer here over the years, starting with the paper of Rosenthal's early on. I don't really now, I think, have time to go through a lot of the details here. Some of these theories, the boundary layer, the majority of the theories are where you impose the wind above the boundary layer and you calculate the winds, the structure of the boundary layer, indicated in the simple flow over a flat plate type of problem. There are one or two papers, like Eliasson and Leistad, and one of Mike and colleagues, and also an unpublished work of Sarah Jones, where the focus is on the spin down of vortices. And in these, the upper flow is actually coupled with the boundary layer flow. But generally, this hasn't been the case or the culture in these kinds of studies. Recently, we came with Steffi Vogel, who's here. We started to look more carefully at some of these previous calculations. And Steffi has a poster showing some of her results on this. And I'm going to talk about a very simple model for the boundary layer based on that work. Kerry's name appeared in some of these papers, and although Kerry's work didn't really look at the boundary layer as such, but was looking at various kinds of models for the hurricane, including theories for potential intensity. And one of the things that Kerry pointed out, which I think is very nice, that where the air goes out of the boundary layer, in the tropics, that air is going to form cloud almost straight away, it's so moist. The boundary layer controls, first of all, that when the air goes up to a first approximation, the lines of constant absolute angular momentum and the lines of constant theta E, or the isentropic surfaces, approximately coincide. In other words, the absolute angular momentum and theta E, the absolute angular momentum is a function of theta E. They're functionally related. And the functional relationship is determined actually by the boundary layer flow, where the air goes up and out of the boundary layer. One of the things that Kerry does is to assume that the relative humidity in here is 80%, and that solves a lot of problems, but it sweeps some problems under the carpet, because then you sort of are basing the boundary layer dynamics on a thermodynamic constraint, which I feel uncomfortable about, and it's one of the things that motivated trying to look in more detail to the boundary layer. So I've been playing around, and Seth has been helping me, to look at a slab boundary layer model. So it might relate to, say, numerical models, many numerical models where the boundary layer just is a single layer of uniform thickness. And essentially what the essence of this model is that we integrate the boundary layer equations through the depth of this layer. And what that does is it gives you a set of equations for the tangential wind speed in the boundary layer, for the radial wind field, for the temperature, and for the mixing ratio or specific humidity in the boundary layer. So you get four ordinary differential equations. I'm looking at a steady problem, it's on an F-plane, it's axisymmetric. The tangential wind field above the boundary layer is prescribed as a function of radius, and we have to also take into account that the boundary layer flow here will be inwards, it will be downwards into the boundary layer out here. There'll be some mean velocity into the boundary layer, and there'll be a velocity out of the boundary layer in the inner core region. It's constant density. We have bulk formulae representing the drag and the heat fluxes at the surface. Simple representation of turbulent fluxes at the top of the boundary layer, which, as I said before, is essentially the top, we think of the top of the subcloud layer. And so what you can do is, now, if you go to large radii, the boundary layer is more or less like an Ekman layer dynamically, so you can forget the nonlinear terms and you can actually get a starting solution out here. And then you could solve the nonlinear equations going inwards towards the center. And also, by a little bit of fiddling around, trying to get the right parameter values, you can set up a convective radiative equilibrium state here so that the surface fluxes of moisture and heat balance the fluxes through the top of the boundary layer and the radiative cooling in the boundary layer. So you can start with an equilibrium state of the boundary layer and then integrate inwards with the tangential wind speed above the boundary layer giving. And in representing these top fluxes, we have some sort of velocity scale, which is can perhaps think of as a representation of shallow convection. So these are the set of integrated equations through the boundary layer. We have the two the radial and tangential momentum equations. The pair of equations here, this chi, is either the static energy in the boundary layer, the dry static energy, or it can be the mixing ratio. And we have a continuity equation, and we have an equation, a diagnostic equation, for the vertical velocity, which is obtained by ensuring that this radial gradient and that one are consistent.
You have a mass balance?
Yeah.
That's the radial kind of equation?
That's
that
this one
right
here.
There? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to go through the details of these solutions, I'll just show you some pictures. This is just, these fluxes here are the fluxes through the top of the boundary layer, and we have a simple representation of those. We have the normal drag coefficients. One of the things maybe I should have mentioned here is that the drag term, because it's the drag is distributed over the boundary layer, and the same with the vertical flux terms, these terms are divided by the depth of the boundary layer. Let me show you some solutions. And when we obtained these solutions a few months ago, we were actually rather surprised by them, but I think we can now explain them. So what we did was we varied the depth of the boundary layer. We don't really know what the depth is in general, but one can look at different depths of the boundary layer The typical depth would be something 500 to 800 meters for typical subcloud layer paths.
Is that a constant in a radial current?
Are you
worried about that? In other words, in the eyeball, doesn't that start to get problematic?
Yeah, probably, but this is the... You can't extend this theory easily to do anything about that. I think you then have to start solving the problem more carefully. Okay, now what this shows is this line here is the tangential wind speed above the boundary layer for a depth of 550 meters. This one here is the tangential wind field in the boundary layer. I realized when I plotted these up that you can't really distinguish between these curves. But this lower one here is the tangential wind speed in the boundary layer, and this is the radial wind speed with a sign change, so it comes in the top part of the picture. So here's the radial wind increasing in magnitude going inwards. Here's the tangential wind speed in the boundary layer, and the tangential wind speed goes supergradient at this point here, becomes larger than the tangential wind speed above the boundary layer. Eventually what happens here is that the radial wind speed goes to zero, and then these equations break down, which is the point that you were making. Now, we then looked at varying the depth of the boundary layer, and we found that at a depth of 679 meters, the solution was much the same as this. And then you increase the depth by 1 meter, and the solution oscillates and becomes regular. You can actually calculate the solution right to the center. And for any depths larger than that, the same thing happens. But in all these solutions, there's a region of flow where the tangential wind flow in the boundary layer is larger than that above the boundary layer. So there's a ubiquitous tendency of the boundary layer to produce supergradient winds in the inner core region.
By about 10?
About
10%.
Mm-hmm. Come back to that in a second. Now, this is an idea I looked up before, mentioned before. We've got converging rings of air in the boundary layer. They're spinning faster. And even though some angular momentum is lost to the surface, if the radial displacement of these rings is big enough, they can spin faster than the air at the top of the boundary layer, in principle, in this model. So supergradient winds, the development of supergradient winds in the core, require large radial displacements. And with minimal frictional loss, that is, these supergradient winds will be preferred by having strong winds in the core, because if not, then the trajectories going round are sort of, if air parcels are only coming in slowly, then they're losing a lot of angular momentum to the surface.
So you've got to have a large inflow rate.
Right. That favours having strong supergradient winds. The only effect which can lead to an inward radial acceleration is the net pressure gradient. Explain why that is so. Friction's acting outwards, downward mixing. There's no radial motion above the boundary layer, so that acts as a brake on the inflow. So the inward radial acceleration increases with the degree to which the boundary layer flow is subgradient. So in the outer part of the flow, the boundary layer is subgradient. And the more it's subgradient, that is, the higher the friction, the stronger the inflow. Now, because of this fact that in the integrated model, the CD gets divided by the depth of the boundary layer, shallow boundary layers have large effective friction, because the actual friction is only spread over a small layer. And so that favors large radial wind speeds. But it favors smaller tangential wind speeds in the outer part of the vortex. But at inner radii, large radial wind speeds favor us a steep increase in the tangential wind speed because we're getting parcels into the center quickly. And that gives a tendency for supergradient winds.
So deeper boundary layers are less prevalent to go supergradient near the radius of maximum wind. Shallower boundary layers are more prevalent.
Right, right.
To go supergradient.
And the transition that I showed occurs if the winds can become subgradient again before the U goes to zero, then it can go, the solutions go regular, they can go right into the center. But if that doesn't happen, the whole boundary layer solution breaks down. I know I'm pretty much, can I have two or three more minutes? Is that a possibility? Because I'm just getting to the interesting bit. So the boundary layer solution breaks down if the radial flow goes to zero. And this happens if it becomes too supergradient. And that happens if the boundary layer depth is small enough. Now, there are some questions raised by these solutions. We have a representation of mixing at the top of the boundary layer, which is necessary to satisfy this convective radiative equilibrium state in the thermodynamics. But if you use this formulation for the fluxes of momentum at the top of the boundary, those fluxes of momentum are comparable with the stresses at the surface. These solutions are really suggesting that not only do you need to get the surface fluxes right in the boundary layer, the surface drag, but you need to know what the drag is at the top of the boundary layer to get the boundary layer right. So, some implications. There's a ubiquitous tendency in this model for the boundary layer winds, for the boundary layer to produce supergradient winds. So, if during the vortex intensification the radial distribution of Vg of R is determined by radial convergence above the layer, so if we have the idea that the tangential wind field above the boundary layer is produced by convergence above the boundary layer, that suggests that the boundary layer would tend to produce stronger tangential wind speeds at inner radii, in particular inside R max. And these stronger tangential winds would then be advected vertically out of the boundary layer, which would lead to a spin up of the core. And I think that's the essence of what Kerry is talking about in your model, where you show that there is this tendency of frontogenesis in the region. I think that's consistent with that idea. But of course, this model then, well, first of all, I mean, that's that remark there, essentially. I don't think I have time to look at that now. I should just go to this. But of course, these calculations suggest that the boundary layer is a fundamental aspect of the spin-up of the inner core, because it's tending to produce supergradient winds, which are then going to turn around and go up and become part of the vortex. But then the big question is it appropriate to prescribe the radial pressure gradient in this inner core region where the flow is out of the boundary layer? Perhaps doesn't make sense, because if you've got tangential winds in the boundary layer which are greater than those that you've imposed above, and those winds are going out, then that doesn't perhaps make sense.
I didn't understand that, because I would think of the radial pressure gradient, if you go back to your flat plate boundary layer, you think of the pressure being imposed by the outer mass field. And just, are you saying there's so much of a dynamic pressure from the inward flow? Because if you look at the hydrostatic component of the pressure, the idea of a boundary layer being thin is saying that through a first approximation, the pressure gradient is set by the mass field externally.
Yeah, but that's above the boundary.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that in a steady problem, those have to be consistent. If you're looking at a steady boundary layer problem, it perhaps doesn't make sense to impose a tangential wind field above the boundary layer, which is different from that in the boundary layer where the air is going out of the boundary layer.
In some sense, there's an incompatibility.
Right. So in a sense, this model is predicting its downfall. Now, what could you do about that? Well, one possibility is you could take where the flow is out of the boundary layer, you could simply reset the tangential wind field to be equal to that in the boundary layer, and that would solve this problem. But then the pressure gradient above the boundary layer will be determined by the assumption of gradient wind balance above the boundary layer. And so you're basically then fixing the boundary layer would be determining the pressure gradient just above it. And that's not consistent with mass balance, as you suggest. The alternative, but one thing that this is suggesting, that perhaps the outer part of the vortex, where this theory seems to be clean, is producing an inward jet at the radius where the vertical velocity goes to zero, so where there is substance into the boundary layer. The boundary layer is producing a jet, and then the question is what happens where the flow starts to go out of the boundary layer. One of the things we've been looking at, and we haven't got quite as far as I would have hoped, but where Steffi is working on this now, is to use this constraint that Kerry had, which relates the theta E in the boundary layer and the tangential wind speed in the boundary layer, or the absolute angular momentum. And then you don't need to prescribe the thermal wind field where the air is going out of the boundary layer. You can actually, you don't have to apply V G of R, you can calculate it as part of the solution. And then you would be satisfying mass balance above the boundary layer. I'm going to finish there. Sorry, I've gone a little bit over.